symphonic variations and arrangements of other composers' music by Gordon Jacob, Thomas Beecham, Constant Lambert and Leopold Stokowski. I'm James Jolly and I hope you've enjoyed my choice of music this morning. Thanks for your company, as always. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this week by Lyndon Jones.
They lie beyond the mountains, far from the reach of major roads.
So far away, my Moscow friends said.
For Radio 3's The Essay, five writers talk about a city which has captured their hearts.
The mountains Fitzroy MacLean called the end of all the earth.
On that first morning, I think I saw John Prescott at breakfast. But perhaps that was another one of those travellers' hallucinations.
A week of programmes culminating with Simon Calder in Cuba.
Well, you might think, not worth going there then. I hope to persuade you otherwise.
The Essay, weeknights on BBC Radio 3 at 10:45.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Alexander Hemon has, in a relatively short space of time, garnered the kind of reviews and appreciation that writers dream of, and justifiably so. His work is at once spare, acute, and touchingly perceptive. His first book was a collection of stories, The Question of Bruno. His novels are Nowhere Man and The Lazarus Project. Just published is The Book of My Lives, which begins in his native Sarajevo. Obviously, displacement is at the heart of a lot of your writing, but I think what's interesting is how that manages to elicit from you a view of human beings and human nature. So it's not just displacement for the sake of displacement, it's the angle that that gives you when you look at life. Is that fair?
I think it is. You know, displacement is traumatic inherently, and initially at least, I experienced it as a trauma to be removed from the place that I had thought and still think defined me in more ways than one. Not just because my roots were there, but rather that my branches were there. I needed and still do need daily interactions with people, daily exchanges, daily learning of the language that is live and developing as we speak, quite literally. So when I was removed from that, and when I left Sarajevo and ended up in Chicago, that to me was traumatic. However, there was a bit of a liberating aspect to that. If we are not quite rooted in place, but we expand into this place around us, then that required for me to assume an agency so that I could establish similar connections in Chicago. And the model for this process was the process that I had gone through in Sarajevo. So I sought things in Chicago that I could connect with. I sought people on various levels, not just friends, but acquaintances, people I could interact with daily. That took a few years, but it also allowed me to not only learn new things, but relearn old things. So that in a very strange way, Sarajevo, as I remembered it, as the city that had defined me, was preserved in the Chicago I live in.
As one goes through the book, and I might even get you to read a little bit from it later, I didn't mention that there's a great deal of humour in it. I did say it was very touching. Indeed, it's moving because the displacement, the final displacement in the last chapter is the death of a child, and there could be nothing more traumatic than that. But I wonder whether you also noticed, as you moved from Sarajevo to America, a complete culture change in terms of things like music. The first music we're going to hear begins in your native country.
Well, I was familiar. I had been familiar with American music, and not just, you know, the current pop music, but, you know, the traditional American music, and was very much interested in, you know, the alternative scenes in New York and Los Angeles and in Chicago. But I had also been interested in classical music, and classical music was less available, not only in record stores, but, you know, I was young and my generation of people was not then invested in classical music. So that one of the things I learned and then relearned to appreciate what I had known already was dependent on my access to classical music. You know, there was a classical radio station. There is a classical radio station in Chicago, which I still listen to most of the time. And at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, eventually I, you know, started going regularly to the concerts once I could afford that. And so the availability of classical music in the United States permitted me to develop in that direction. And this did not make me regret all the other music that I had liked, but rather I learned to appreciate it in a different way, including the traditional Bosnian music that you mentioned, Sevdah.
It's a kind of fado, the first piece we're going to hear, and it involves a friend of yours.
It is similar to fado in that it's a kind of, and Bosnians would recognize fado as something close to their heart, in that it is music that finds joy in sadness. And this is not perverse masochistic kind of joy, but rather, you know, life is difficult and often sad, but at least we can sing about it. And so there's this particular combination that touches me and which in all of art I respond to.
It could be a credo for your writing.
Yes, I would hope so, yes. It's similar in the blues, but then there's a joy in this performance, the joy of life and joy of daily practices. So that if the performance is good, then the song is very sad, but then the performance is so beautiful that it results in joy. And this is performed by Amira, who's someone I know from Sarajevo. She's a relatively young person, so she's into rock and roll. She's not a rural kind of person. That is, she relearned to appreciate this music, which had been around in Bosnia for many centuries.
And the title of the song in English would be?
Would be, My Rose Has Bloomed This Morning.
Oh,
a beautiful song, and she has a lovely voice too.
She has, yes, she has a heartbreaking voice, yes. Yeah. This kind of music is traditionally performed with the accordion or a simpler string instruments. So this is a somewhat modern arrangement. It's revived, as it were, the genre with, you know, new sensibilities.
So that was Amira, and I think you'll have to correct me. It's Jutros mi ruža procvjetala.
Jutros mi ruža procvjetala. That was close enough, close enough.
Thank you. Now, you mentioned, Alexander Hemon, that in America you cottoned on to a lot of classical music, Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And the next piece is one of the great sort of bastions of the classical world in terms of music, and it's Bach, St. Matthew Passion. Did you discover this live or on a recording?
I was at home one day and was listening to a classical music station and had just turned it on, and I missed the introduction, and a St. Matthew Passion was playing, and I did not know what it was, but I sat down and listened to it for 3 hours, and it was a revelation to me. I had known Bach, and I had been a fan of Brandenburg Concertos and various other pieces, but for some reason, I had not been familiar with St. Matthew's Passion. It was one of the most profound musical experiences in my life. I guess it was Easter time, and I dropped whatever I had been doing and just sat in a chair without moving for 3 hours. And it is my favorite piece of music, of any kind of music. And this particular aria, Blue Tenure, is one of its highlights, for sure.
Thank you. Blute nur du liebes Herz from the St. Matthew Passion of Bach. We heard Irmgard Seyfried with the Munich Bach Orchestra, conducted by Carl Richter. Just before we move on to David Bowie, which actually brings us to some very interesting thoughts about serious pop music, I thought it'd be nice to hear a little bit from your book, The Book of My Lives, from the earlier part where you are talking about some of the things that you and your friends got up to actually not only amuse yourselves, but to try and sort of discover who you were, I guess.
Yes, this was at a time when I was one of the people programming a club that we called Wallens Nolens. And it was, in fact, I who tried to organize a performance of John Cage music because I had never heard it and the records were not available. And so we organized it so I could hear it. Anyway, this is from my book. We organized a performance of John Cage's music, the first and possibly the only one ever in Sarajevo. We played records with a composition performed by 12 simultaneously screeching radios and the infamous 4 minutes 33 seconds, a stretch of silence on the record, which was supposed to provide the time for the audience to create its own inadvertent incidental music. The audience, however, consisting by this time mainly of the idle elite, did notice that 4 minutes 33 seconds was playing at all, didn't give a diddly beep about the music it was itself producing, and was instead getting happily drunk. Then the performer, who had traveled to Sarajevo foregoing a family vacation at the peril of divorce, stepped in front of the microphone. The few audience members who glanced at the stage saw a hairy man eating an orange and a banana in front of the microphone, performing, unbeknownst to almost everyone present, the John Cage composition appropriately titled An Orange and a Banana. It was irritating not to be irritating to the elite, so even on the nights when we just spun records, the goal was to inflict pain. Gusha, the DJ, played Frank Zappa, Yoko Ono, Screaming in Dissonance, and Einstürzende den Neubauten, the fine German musicians who liked to use chainsaws and power drills to produce music. The elite was undeterred, though it shrank in numbers. We wanted them to be there so as to experience severe mental pain. This concept did not fly too well with the socialist hippies.
Now, David Bowie, because this is where I think you find great joy in pop music, which has some depth to it.
I do. When I was a teenager, in my early adolescence, someone gave me Heroes, the seminal David Bowie album, as a birthday present. And I had known about Bowie and may have even known some of his bigger hits. But Heroes was a different animal. It was ambitious, it was moody, it was challenging. And it changed the way I thought about pop music, in that it was serious and still, you know, hummable and singable. But it was serious, it was ambitious, it was about something. The album was produced in Berlin, West Berlin.
I think
Berlin,
he was working with Brian Eno.
He was working with Brian Eno, and Brian Eno was instrumental in it, and the influence is still audible of Brian Eno. But Brian Eno and David Bowie, and this album in particular, they were a gateway to further discoveries. I remember developing interest in Kafka because something Bowie did, and very possibly this very album, was described in some magazine as Kafkaesque, and I thought, what is that? And I started reading the process, the trial, that is. But also, I think I got to John Cage via Brian Eno, because in some interview or in some review of his airport music or any of his projects outside of his collaboration with Bowie, John Cage was referenced, and I wanted to know what it was, and I read more about John Cage. So by the time of this performance that I just read about, I had learned much about John Cage. I just hadn't heard anything, and this performance was to complete that picture.
Just for one day. because we're lovers. That is a fact. Yes, we're lovers. That is that. For nothing will keep us together. We could steal time just for one day. Can be heroes forever and ever. What you say? Dolphins can swim. Though nothing, nothing will keep us together. We can beat them forever and ever. Oh, we can be heroes just for one day.
David Bowie, Heroes, words by Bowie and music by Bowie and Brian Eno.
You know, and Heroes, them on the other side, this was recorded at the wall. Staring at the wall is staring at the Berlin Wall, and the shame being on the other side is, well, on the other side of the wall. There was a little shame on this side, but that was a different story. And this heroic notion that by kissing at the wall, you can be a hero for a day, that there's this particular form of agency. This was appealing to me as a teenager. But it's also, in some ways, it's essential to art, and particularly narrative art in my mind, because it's a field of individual agency. In history and politics, there has to be some kind of collective organized agency or to make any kind of change. That's the them, right? But we here means two people who might be kissing. So that's the biggest number of we's that is allowed in this kind of art. It's somewhat obviously neo-romantic, but it was greatly appealing to me as a young person. And it still is. I mean, I still respond to the drama of Heroes, as I do respond to the drama of his most recent song, Who Are We Now?
It's interesting how all of his music has that slight feeling. You know, we were talking earlier about the Bosnian music, that aspirational, that yearning for something we can never quite attain, which is at the basis of so much creativity.
Exactly, and that's the drama of it. I mean, in Heroes, there's this wailing guitar, and, you know, who are we? We can be heroes just for one day, but we still do not know who we are. There's this evanescence to this great gesture, to this great drama, and the joy of performance, which is always limited, is inscribed in it. So it cannot be a lasting thing. It only lasts for as long as the performance lasts.
If Bowie, Alexander Hammond, took pop music into new vistas with Brian Eno, I guess you could say much the same of Charlie Mingus and jazz.
I'm a big fan of Charlie Mingus in more ways than one. I think that his work in the 60s, it was closely connected with the civil rights movement in many ways. And one of them was this ambition and seriousness of the music. He took jazz far beyond any notion of entertainment. It was art by the time he laid his hands on it, and he took it to another level. On the one hand, he referred to the tradition, so that there's a tune called Letter to the Duke. He also wrote music for ballet, and he experimented in ways that were eye-opening to an entire generation of music and musicians, that is. In our household, Mingus is practically a deity. So my daughter's imaginary friend is named Mingus. Imaginary brother, I'm sorry, is named Mingus. The name we suggested, because before that he didn't really have a name. And we said, how about Mingus? Because Mingus was playing on the sound system as we were talking about that. when I write, all kinds of processes happen, and often I'm forced to explain them to others and to myself. And one of the ways to explain it is the way I write is not unlike, as I imagine, jazz musicians create things. That is, there's a framework, but within this framework, there's a space for improvisation, and you seek things and experiment and go this way and that way, and trying to figure out how far you can stretch the limits that you set out for yourself, but also how to explore all the spaces within those limits. And so this helped me in more ways than one to understand why I am doing things the way I'm doing them. And in that sense, jazz, and particularly the kind of jazz that Charlie Mingus played, which is both spontaneous and tightly controlled, simultaneously, as it were, that you know that he knew what he was doing, but at the same time, there's this expansive freedom. That is something that I strive for, both the architecture and the feeling that comes from spontaneity.
Spontaneity is such a fascinating thing. As a composer, sometimes some people will mention to me a project they'd like, or they'd like something set. And I've taught myself that if I go away and actually hear something in my head, to write it down, because although I might throw it away,
right,
and often do, it could actually be the kernel of what I need, because that's been the first reaction to that idea.
Right, yeah, that makes perfect sense. It is that the process of writing is the beginning of exploration. It's not the end of the process, but it is the one of the first steps in the process. So that once I put the pen on the paper, that means I'm entering a space and I'm going to spend some time here, probably lost. But I'm going to learn about that space. I'm going to understand it. And then when I get out, I will know how to reorganize it next time I go in.
Boogie Stop Shuffle from Mingus, Charlie Mingus and his group there. Now, you mentioned that he'd done an open letter to Duke, and it is Duke we come on to, isn't it?
It is. I mean, Duke is in many ways, I mean, with Louis Armstrong, he's one of the saints of jazz. Of course, Mingus recorded Money Jungle with Duke and Max Roach, which was one of the great jazz records. But Duke laid out the foundation on which much of the jazz after him, and since he had a career of about 50 years, or in fact more, I think, you know, he was the constant presence in the history of jazz, metaphorically and physically. For my money, he's the greatest American composer of the 20th century.
And for this composition, he teamed up with another great guy, Billy Strayhorn.
Right, well, yeah, Billy Strayhorn was instrumental in his big band project. This is from a later phase in his life, and somewhat neglected, unjustly so, when his big band traveled around the world and he wrote these suites, the Latin American suite, the Far East suite, the Euro-Asian suite, which are brilliant in more ways than one. They were not as popular as his, you know, classical tunes that were played and replayed by generations of jazz musicians. But some of his most beautiful music is on these albums.
Thank you.
A lovely piece of music. It always touches me. I love that it's called Isfahan, which is a town in Iran. I don't know the story behind the song, but there is this longing that I find familiar that might be a form of Orientalism to project into Iran, but still, I find it familiar.
It's wonderful the way that sax tune, which I suspect is Johnny Hodges, is interrupted. I mean, it's a legato line, but the accompaniment's often going boop,
right,
boop, boop. And to have that combination of something that is held and sustained and that sort of staccato jazz interruption makes a wonderful combination.
Yeah, I think so. I hadn't thought about it this way because, you know, the foreground is this melodic line by the saxophone that I find myself humming to myself very often, but it is dependent on this background of other musicians. As someone who works alone, I have this theoretical longing for collaborative work. And one of the great regrets of my life is never really being serious about music enough, or serious at all, in fact, to work with other people. I fantasize about the interactions and discussions, and not even discussions, just connections, you know, exchanges of glances and just sensing when and how to do particular things. I fantasize about a relationship with someone the way that, you know, Duke and Billy Strayhorn related and how they understood each other's ideas.
Duke Ellington, Isfahan by Ellington and Strayhorn, and from the album The Far East Suite. Finally, Alexander Hammond, we're going to quite a considerable piece in its own right, and it's a single movement from a Mahler symphony, a particularly beautiful one, recorded famously by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and Scholte. Has Mahler been a composer that you've been particularly touched by?
He has. One of the first classical music records I own as a teenager in Sarajevo was Mahler's first symphony. And it's one of my favorite pieces and one of the pieces I'm most attached to. And for some reason, Mahler, in his, you know, famous messiness, intense combination of various motifs and traditions and the piling on of many, many things, it is stimulating to my brain. For example, I was writing a story and I had a problem with the ending and I didn't know how to resolve it and was at a performance of Mahler's first in Chicago, Chicago Symphony. And I wasn't even thinking about the story at all. I was listening to music, but suddenly, somehow, the bottom fell off. And the solution to the problem presented itself to me as if someone turned on the light. And I have no explanation for that at all, other than that somehow music stimulates the same part of the brain the part of the brain that is stimulated by music participates in narrative construction in a way that I cannot really control rationally.
So do you listen to music while you write?
Absolutely, all the time. I cannot, it's very difficult. I could if pressed, but it's very difficult for me to write without music.
You see, the interesting thing there is, I think, that if you were a sort of a musician, an analytical musician, you'd find it distracting because the brain cannot stop but analyze the music. But right. If you're a writer, it obviously bears fruit in a different way.
Well, I guess my advantage is that I cannot analyze the music because I cannot quite read it, and I'm not theoretically educated in music. So to me, it is a continuum, a flow, and that comports with my feeling that writing, as I'm doing it, is a sort of a flow. It's like running or playing a football game where you cannot stop to analyze this particular thing the way you could analyze some other things. Only after the fact can I return to it to analyze. So it puts me into a flow mode, as it were, the music.
This adagietto is very famous and was used in a film, Death in Venice, to extraordinary effect. And it does show, doesn't it, how music can colour anything you're listening to when it's married to it.
I think I got to Mahler through Death in Venice, the movie, because I was a film buff and would go to the Cinematheque in Sarajevo, you know, where they were showing old movies, and they were showing Death in Venice. And so the music was extraordinarily beautiful. And so this is why one of my first classical music records was Mahler. It is still connected with Death in Venice, but because I listened to Mahler so much after that, it's decoupled from it too. And however, this adagietto, is still there's a hint of death, more than a hint of death.
And displacement.
Not just from Venice, yes. Mm.
The extraordinary thing about that music is that, rather as in Strauss or piece like Metamorphosen, for example, is it has such a wonderful arch to it. So it has that yearning quality, transcendence, but this long arch.
There is an arch, it flows. There are no parts to the arch. You can see it forming, or hear it forming, rather, as it develops. I like art and music in particular that is simultaneously producing intense feelings, but also thought. You know, what T.S. Eliot talked about, the dissociation of sensibilities that presumably took place in, I don't know, 17th, 18th century. It comes back occasionally in great pieces of art, and Mahler is full of that. This, to me, brings tears to my eyes, yet at the same time, you can hear the thinking behind it, and that's the remarkable accomplishment.
The Adagietto, Sehr Langsam, from Symphony No. 5 by Mahler, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Scholte. Well, happily, Alexander Hammond, your choice of music rather mirrors your book, because we begin in Sarajevo and we end with something which is ineluctably moving. So it's a rather nice counterpart. Thank you very much, Alexander Hammond.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Alexander Hammond was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, there's another chance to hear the dancer Tamara Rocco, formerly with the Royal Ballet and now Artistic Director of English National Ballet, talking to Michael about her personal musical enthusiasms. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
Opera on 3, live from the Met, with Handel's Giulio Cesare. British Baroque specialist Harry Bickett conducts a starry cast including David Daniels, Natalie Dessay and Alice Coote. Saturday afternoon on BBC Radio 3 from 5 o'clock.
Well, back to today, and looking ahead to 2 o'clock, we've a concert recorded at Nottingham's Royal Concert Hall. It's given by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Yutaka Sado. They'll be starting with Rimsky-Korsakov's exciting Capriccio Espagnol. Then Ruth Palmer will be the violin soloist in Korngold's Violin Concerto. And the concert ends with Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, the one in F minor. That's our Sunday concert this afternoon at 2 o'clock. And that's here on BBC Radio 3. We're on 90.93 FM, also on digital radio and online. Well, the time now is 1 o'clock. It's time for the news with David Cornett.
Competitors in the London Marathon have stood in silence to express their support for the victims of the bombs which targeted last week's race in Boston. A hush descended across the start line as thousands of runners remembered the three people who were killed and the 170 people who were injured. Security was high in London, but there have been no reports of any incidents. Police in Boston have revealed that the two brothers they suspect of carrying out the bombings in the city had admitted their guilt. The police chief in the suburb of Watertown said the men made the admission to a motorist they'd abducted during a carjacking. Rescue teams in southwestern China are struggling to reach isolated hill villages that were devastated in a powerful earthquake which struck the region yesterday. More than 200 people have been confirmed dead, 11,000 were injured. India's Prime Minister says his country has vast improvements to make on women's safety and that it was everyone's responsibility to provide security to women. His comments follow demonstrations in the capital, Delhi, yesterday after a 5-year-old girl was abducted and subjected to an horrific sexual attack lasting 2 days. The United States has committed itself to doubling its non-lethal aid to Syrian opposition forces. The US Secretary of State, John Kerry, said the extra money, amounting to more than $120 million, would go beyond the current provision of food and medical supplies, but he did not elaborate. An official song released to mark the beginning of the reign of the new Dutch monarch, King Willem-Alexander, has been withdrawn after tens of thousands of people signed a petition calling it imbecilic. They were annoyed at the mix of styles, including rap and choir music, as well as its lyrics and grammar. And the weather, it's dry and sunny in the southeast and will remain dry until much later. A band of rain will gradually move southeastwards, easing as it goes. Further north and west, the rain may be heavy at times. Brighter weather with showers will follow behind. BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past one.
Read by David Cornett. I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. At 5 o'clock this afternoon in the choir, the composer, conductor and record producer John Rutter will be celebrating the diversity of choral music making in and around the university colleges at Cambridge. We'll be hearing works by Vaughan Williams, Rachmaninoff, Judith Weir, Purcell and Elgar, and there'll be interviews with directors, choristers and musicians of the colleges. That's the choir, 5 o'clock this afternoon. But now it's time for today's early music show, and here's Catherine Bott.
Hello. Are you sitting comfortably, perhaps sipping a restorative coffee from your favourite mug? Or maybe you're enjoying a grumpy old listener moment, complaining fruitlessly against the takeover of our high streets by coffee shops and all their rococo potions whose titles end in chino. Well, either way, you're being deeply, authentically baroque, because caffeine dependency is nothing new. Coffee came to Europe from the Arab world in the late 16th century. In the year 1600, Pope Clement VIII pronounced it OK for Catholics to drink, and the first European coffee house opened in Venice in 1645. This stimulating new beverage was officially good for you. In 1661, an English pamphlet declared that 'tis extolled for drying up the crudities of the stomach and for expelling fumes out of the head. Hope that hasn't put you off your next mouthful. But coffee houses were definitely for William and the Outlaws, not for Violet Elizabeth. Women were banned from them in England. They got their own back in 1674 with the Women's Petition Against Coffee, which claimed that the excessive use of that newfangled, abominable, heathenish liquor was inclined to unman their husbands. But in Germany it was a different story. For today's early music show, we're off to Leipzig, where Zimmermann's Coffee House and the Collegium Musicum played a significant part in establishing a new musical idea, public concerts. And young ladies in Leipzig were defying their fathers and drinking coffee every day, according to Bach. Thank you. how sweet is the taste of coffee, more delicious than a thousand kisses. Emma Kirkby doing the Java Jive with Christopher Hogwood and the Academy of Ancient Music in a winning aria from Bach's Coffee Cantata, the story of a pert young miss who'd almost rather have coffee than a handsome husband. The Coffee Cantata was a little operetta for grouchy father and wily daughter. You couldn't imagine anything more different from Bach's usual cantata offerings, but that's because this one was written not for a Sunday service, but to be enjoyed by people on a Friday night out. We'll return to Bach later on, but to get to the roots of the Collegium Musicum tradition that was so important in Leipzig, we have to go back a few decades. It's easy to speed-read the phrase Collegium Musicum as music college, but it's more about musical colleagues, like-minded people getting together to play and sing. And despite the Latin title, it was German-speaking countries that went for the idea. From the late 16th to the mid-18th centuries, if you lived in a sizeable town, or more especially a university town, then you'd probably have come across a Collegium Musicum, a club for music lovers and amateur musicians alike, with regular gatherings where town met gown. There was a new middle class coming up to occupy the space between chapels.